My name is Ashok Mohanraj, and this is the I Speak for the Trees podcast. Ulakut Uvanga Ashok Ativa. What's going on, guys? It's your boy Ash, and you're listening to this week's episode of the I Speak for the Trees podcast, Arctic Exploration 101. So for those of you who don't know what I just said, it's pretty much good morning. My name is Ashok in Inuktitut, which is the language that the Inuit people of Canada speak. And so for those of you who don't know who are new to the podcast or the blog platform or whatever, I recently had the opportunity to go on a high Arctic field expedition or field research course through the Canadian High Arctic, the Northwest Passage, and a little bit of Western Greenland. And so pretty much what we were doing is focusing on human and physical aspects of geography and kind of doing some research there. So mostly on the physical side, glaciology, oceanography, geomorphology, permafrost melt, rate of retreats, things like that. And then on the human side, we kind of looked into things like food insecurity, preservation and culture, tourism, economic opportunities, shipping opportunities, things like that. And so my plan was, actually, so before I went on this trip, I put out a call for questions that people wanted to have answered about the high Arctic, because not many people get to experience it. So I wanted to kind of record the experiences like in real time, so that way you guys could live the experience vicariously through this podcast. And so I actually brought the microphone and stuff with me on the ship, which was kind of a hassle because it took up like 5 pounds of my luggage. But anyways, the problem, like I genuinely tried to record some content. Like I did some interviews, got some live footage of conversations, and did some daily debriefs. But the problem is, when you're on a ship, there's the constant engine that's running, so you have the constant vibrations, so the mic's always shaking, and then you always had the crashing of the waves against like the windows and stuff like that. So it was hard to get some quality sound bites out of this, and like I didn't want to carry the podcast equipment out with me on the Zodiac and like during Arctic excursions, because that would be totally inconvenient, and that would just take away from the experience that I want to kind of fully embrace with the environment there. So I apologize that I didn't get to kind of do that live recording of the content. So what I'm going to do here is going to try to give a little bit of a quick summary, taking the questions that people had asked me prior to going on the trip and kind of conglomerating them into kind of a series of points. I'm going to quickly kind of go through like a spark notes kind of thing of what it's like living in the Arctic and being in one of the last frontiers. And so you can kind of experience what the environment's like, how the environment is changing, the impacts of climate change, what the people are like, how climate change is impacting them and their culture, and things like that. So without further ado, I'm going to try getting into the meat of this podcast and kind of answer all your questions. And hopefully by the end of it, you gain some insight on what it's like being in the Canadian High Arctic, because not everyone gets to experience that. So I want to make sure I give as much detail as possible, because it is truly like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Like, my justification going there was, got to see the glaciers before they melt. So anyways, stay tuned. The next couple, like next half an hour, I'm going to go through what it's like being in the High Arctic. So originally my plan was to have like a 5 to 10 part series of like each different topic, each in its own episode. But now I realize how impractical that's going to be. So I'm going to end up just doing all of these kind of topics into one. And I'm going to try to keep it as brief but as detailed as possible, because I don't want to bore you guys. But I do want to give you guys the full breadth of the Arctic experience. Wildlife in the Arctic, specifically polar bears, or Papa Bravos. I'm going to start with polar bears and wildlife, because like a lot of people responded, they just want to know about the polar bears, and that's kind of what everyone thinks of when they think of the Arctic. They either think of polar bears, or the North Pole, Santa Claus, or Coca-Cola, or some shit like that. Also, just wanted to point out before anyone expects anything on penguins, penguins are not found in the Arctic. They're only found in Antarctica. Just a disclaimer, because a lot of people still think that they're found in the Arctic, which they are not. So I'm just going to make that clear before we get started. Okay, so wildlife in the Arctic, it is extremely unique because some of the animals you see here are animals that you cannot see anywhere else. For example, the polar bears, which is what most people come for. And so if we're gonna be, I'm gonna, you guys know me, like my whole platform is about being transparent and being genuine and being authentic, right? So I'm not gonna sugarcoat what the experience was like, but seeing polar bears was probably the highlight of the wildlife experience, because when you're on the Zodiac, so the Zodiacs are pretty much small boats, but they're boats, but like they're just kind of like rubber, they're essentially like inflatable rubber boats, and you just sit on the side, a kind of inflated chamber. They're not, there's no actual seats or anything. They're just a motor and just some empty space in the middle, and that's what you're kind of sitting on when you're, because when you're leaving from the ship to go on land for excursions, or when you're trying to like navigate through sea ice around the ship or things like that, you're going onto the Zodiac and you're just kind of navigating around on a small little motorboat that's made of rubber. And so that's really cool because you get to go like really up close to the animals, or not super up close, but you get to get relatively close. I'd say within about 100 meters, because safety issues. You can't see wildlife if you're dead, right? So safety is the number one priority. But anyways, yeah, so the polar bear aspect was really cool because it felt like you were in like a National Geographic documentary. Like you had to be super quiet and you'd be following around these, like you'd look it through your binoculars, you spot like a white fuzz and you'd be like, oh my God, polar bear, polar bear. And like the code name that we used was Papa Bravo. And to be honest with you, I don't know why there was a code name for polar bears or animals in any case. It's not like they're gonna understand you, but anyways, I just thought it was funny that they used Papa Bravo. So every time there's a polar bear, be like Papa Bravo at 3 o'clock, Papa Bravo at 12 o'clock, or something like that. But anyways, yeah, it was just really cool because you just always be on the lookout. Like sometimes it would be hard because it's like, is that a rock or is that a polar bear? And so it would be difficult. It's difficult seeing these animals in the landscape, especially when you're far away. But as I mentioned, it's really cool being able to get up close. Like for example, we saw some polar bears swimming. We saw some hiding on like the kind of the coastline behind some ice, and it's just really cool to see like it's so much different than seeing them in like a zoo or like on TV. Like seeing them in real life, it's like holy shit, these are amazing creatures. They're beautiful creatures, and like it's just it you like I don't even know what to say because it's just like you can't just like you have to see it for yourself, but it's just really amazing to be able to see how they interact in a natural environment. Like they're not kind of they're not subdued in a enclosed confinement or something like that. Like they have the ability to roam free, they have the ability to do what they want, and they're like interacting. Like we saw one mama bear with her cub too, and that was just really cool to see the whole family dynamic of that as well. And like people think that when a lot of the images that come out were of like climate change propaganda. They show polar bears like skinny and starving and like trapped on sea ice or whatnot, and like isolated. But for like personally, the polar bears that we saw, they looked pretty healthy. And the area that we were, there was plenty of food. There's an abundance of food, so the polar bears looked relatively healthy. But in terms of like numbers, there weren't like that many. I'd say I expected to see a lot more, but I'd say probably the total of maybe about a dozen polar bears. But it was just really cool being able to see those and kind of tracking their movement. And actually, one time we were about to do some measurements, some field measurements at one of the glaciers, Cunningham Glacier, and we were going to be like the first ever scientist to take physical data from that site. And so we were like right at the edge of the glacier, like the glacial ice cave. And then unfortunately, someone from a Zodiac on the water saw a polar bear coming towards us. And there was like Papa Bravo incoming, right? And we're like, shit, we gotta go. Like we were so close to the glacier, and we were like right about to do our sampling and stuff like that. And then we had to evacuate because obviously polar bears will kick the shit out of you. They'll eat you. They'll do anything to protect themselves, especially when you make them, when you aggravate them, when you because they're very like hostile animals. They want to protect their territory. So yeah, we always have someone carrying a rifle with us at all times, especially for polar bear excursions. In fact, like before we go out on any land excursions, there's always like a team that goes out like 2 hours prior to kind of scout the land to see if there's any polar bears and kind of make sure the coast is clear. Because if there are polar bears on site, we kind of just avoid that in general because we don't want to have any confrontation. Like even if we are equipped to handle a situation, like, we don't want to make the polar bears exert any more kind of like physical energy, or we don't want to disrupt their like feeding patterns and things like that. So we want to leave nature as it is and kind of not have to make them accommodate to humans, because that's not the way it's intended to be. But yeah, that's for polar bears anyways. Also saw a lot of whales, so bowhead, which is like the super huge ass whales with like, I don't know how much tons, they're like hundreds and hundreds of tons. There's a huge one with like the really big jaw. Beluga whales, narwhals are the ones with the really long like tusk made of ivory. And then seals, arctic fox, birds, muskox. So the thing with whales, like honestly, like a lot of people go whale watching, and for me, just like, it's like, it's not that exciting, to be honest. Like, you don't even, like, it's cool to see it, like, because you don't get to see it anywhere else, but honestly, you just see the tail coming up and then it back in, right? It's just like, you see like a little sprout, like the sprout of water coming up when they're breathing. But it's like, it's amazing to see. It's like really cool to see it outside in the natural environment, just taking place naturally, and it's kind of like beautiful and harmonious, like it's in a movie or something, like blissful. But you know, it's not that exciting. Like, I wouldn't go and pay to go whale watching, you know what I mean? Like, it's cool just to see it as like a coincidence, but like, I'm not gonna sit on a boat and wait for hours and hours to see a splash of water and a little tail, right? But you know, some people do find that intrinsically beautiful. Like, I find it intrinsically beautiful, but I'm not gonna waste my time. Like, I'm not saying I don't appreciate it, but I'm just saying, if you're into, if that's one of the reasons why you'd want to go to the Arctic, that's just my opinion. Like, don't go for just for whales. Anyways, there were plenty of seals. Actually, the closest interaction we got with an animal was a little cute little seal, little chunker, just chilling, sunbathing on a piece of sea ice that broke off. And so, yeah, they're harmless. They're just kind of minding their own business. They usually swim in packs. So those, their seals are really cute. But yeah, like I said, like, they're just so unique to that environment. And it's just so cool to see them outside of a confined space. Like, and just, like, they're so, like, because they're endemic to the Arctic, it's, like, something that not everyone gets to experience. And it's just, like, it's so weird being able to see them. Like, because normally, from 90% of the people, you would only see this through nature documentaries, National Geographic, or whatever. But to see it in real life, it's something different. It's something like, it's just, you get to realize, like, these creatures exist in our world. We live alongside them. We have to coexist with each other and kind of understand that relationship and kind of understand how they survive, how we survive, and how we use one another to survive. And it's just, it's a crazy world, man. And so, yeah, and then Arctic fox are cute. Birds are birds. They just look like seagulls. But I'm not, the bird guy on the boat would be offended if I said that to him. But honestly, all the birds looked like just seagulls, but a little bit whiter. Anyways, and then, yeah, we saw some muskox on land. Muskox are pretty cool. But yeah, like I said, the main thing was polar bears. And polar bears are just, it was just amazing to see those creatures up close. I know they seem like really cute and cuddly, but they're actually like very ferocious and dangerous animals. It's just, it's a nice balance, you know what I mean? Like, from far away, they're really cute and cuddly, but you also have to be scared as fuck, because you don't know, at any time they could come and just like rip your organs to shreds, so you never know, right? But honestly, it was just amazing to be able to see that, because they are such an endangered and such a threatened species. I think it's important that we realize that their ecosystem is collapsing, and so it's a lot harder for them to survive. And so it's just nice to see these species kind of, for me, like, anyways, in this situation, to see them flourishing, to see them have to be living healthy lives and kind of interacting, going about their day and things like that. But anyways, also, I just want to point out that wildlife is very intertwined with society. Like, it's so ingrained. Like, nature, wildlife, they're not separate entities from human. Like, for example, like, all the animals that I mentioned, polar bears, whales, seals, fox, muskox, things like that, they're all intertwined with dances, foods, clothes, art, so things like that. So we went to like a performance in a community called Pond Inlet, and their traditional drum dancing performance, the sounds and the movements they make are meant to imitate the animals. So they would have like polar bear movements and muskox movements and whale movements, and it's even stuff as simple as that, like it's so intertwined with what they do. And like their food, most of their food, their traditional game food, is heavily reliant on those foods. So a lot of people will hunt seal and whales for sustenance. So a lot of people will be eating whales and things like that just to get their nutrition, right? Because there's not much else available, and that's kind of the way they live off the land, and that's kind of the way of life, and that's what they're so used to. They don't know anything else, right? That's what they were taught. That's what they were raised with, and so it's just a part of who they are and part of their culture and tradition. Even the clothes that they wear, they're all made from animal furs, various animal furs, caribou furs, seal skin, fox skin, things like that. And so even like art as well, like a lot of people make their livelihoods off selling art. So they have to be able to harvest whatever, it's ivory off a narwhal, or if it's fur from an animal, or if it's bones or something to carve. Like that's, it's all interconnected, it's all very, it's all about using everything off the land. It's not just making sure nothing goes to waste. And that's something that I think we as a Western culture have to kind of recognize, is that we're not separate from nature. We're not here to dominate. We're not here to impose our will, but we're here to kind of think of them as a holistic system. Think of them like a mutually symbiotic relationship. You know, they help us, we help them, and kind of that understanding of respect and kind of using things to their full potential, treating them with respect and sustainability and care and things like that, not just kind of for commercial use and kind of capitalization and things like that. It's all about, basically just comes down to a respect for the land, right? And that's something we have to kind of recognize, especially back here in our civilized society. Or like, we say we're civilized, but are we really civilized when you think about the things that we do when we mass slaughter animals and things like that? So it's just an interesting concept to recognize that the way of life there is very, very different. And that's just in terms of the wildlife. Like, you would never see, like, if you're from Toronto, you know, there's like bear, raccoons and squirrels. Like, you never see someone integrate their culture so heavily surrounded by like raccoons and squirrels, right? No one's gonna be dancing about raccoons or squirrels, or making squirrel art, shit like that, right? Because it's not a thing. Like, it's not a thing that happens here, because we're so separated from nature. We think that we're two separate entities, and we don't have that kind of respect, and we don't kind of have that relationship with the animals. And that makes sense because of where we are geographically. But at the same time, we have to understand that, like, I know there's a lot of backlash against people who like hunt for traditional food because they're like killing endangered animals and things like that. But we have to understand where they're coming from, what they know, like, has been passed on from generations and generations. And so, yeah, like, what we know as wildlife is completely different from what Inuit and Indigenous people know as wildlife, because they're two different, like, geographically speaking, we're in two completely different areas. Economically speaking, we're in two economically different areas. Socially speaking, two socially separate areas. Like, you can't group everyone into, you can't expect everyone to kind of act the same way or have the same ideologies. You have to respect how people use the land and like how they need to survive as well. Like, at the end of the day, it's all about taking care of yourself and making sure that you put your own food on the table so that way you can survive, right? So that's a really important part to understand. Exactly how cold is the Arctic? So in all honesty, it's really not that cold. Like, people just assume that like the Arctic is just always cold all year round, like it has no seasons. Like, we were there in the summer, so like obviously seasons affect the globe on a worldwide scale. So it does get warm in the Arctic, and so like the coldest it got was maybe like minus 15, and like the warmest it got was like, I don't know, I want to say like 8 degrees, right? So like it wasn't too bad. Like, it wasn't, like, we weren't shivering all the time. Like, it wasn't a barren landscape with ice and snow blowing through your face all the time. Like, it's not that bad. And, like, the water's not always frozen. So that's just a thing I wanted to point out. Like, it's not a frozen landscape all year round. You know what I mean? It goes through changes, and it is affected by seasonal changes. What are the visible and intermediate impacts of climate change? So this is a big one. This is kind of what we came here to do research on. So I'm going to cover like some of the more prominent ones. So the main thing that we kind of we're looking at are glaciers and how fast they're receding. And so you can actually, if you look at satellite images from previous years, so from like 2017, 2018, 2019, you can visibly see how far the glacier has receded. And it's like a significant amount. Even the locals, when you talk to the locals, they notice each year it gets smaller and smaller, and you can see kind of the deposits of sediment where the glacier was last year, and then when it recedes, you see the new kind of piles of sediment leading back and back and back. You can see each year how much it recedes based on where the sediment piles line up. And so, like, yeah, we talk about, oh yeah, the Arctic is melting, the ice is melting, the glaciers are melting, blah blah blah, but we don't see it. Now that I've actually seen it, it's a lot different, because it's just like, fuck, it's not just, people are saying this, it's not just data, like, actually seeing with your own two eyes, it's like, this shit's melting, and it's melting fast, so, like, we gotta do something about it, or else, like, surprisingly, like, when you think about it, there's not much ice on this planet, so pretty much, it's just, most of the Canadian ice sheet is melted. There's, like, a little bit left in Ellesmere Island. Most of it comes from the Greenland ice sheet. And then other than that, it's just what's left in Antarctica. So there's really not much. Like the Canadian, like there's, we say high Arctic, but when we talk about ice that kind of regulates temperature and kind of that controls the world's global thermostat or whatnot, it's really just kind of Greenland that kind of has the majority of the ice. Like, yeah, sure, Russia, Canada, and those Northern European countries might have some. But on the grand scheme of things, Greenland has the most ice. And so, yeah, we saw some of those glaciers. You can see how fast it's receding. And it's kind of scary. Like, I think we saw, like, in Greenland, the amount that comes off per year on one of the glaciers, the amount of fresh water trapped and the amount of ice lost is enough to satisfy the United States consumption of fresh water within a year. So that's a hell of a lot of water being lost in the form of ice each year. And so if you think about that, it's going to continue to happen. It's going to probably increase at a faster rate given our current path of trajectory. So it's some scary stuff. And like when you see it, it's just like you see how massive it is. You see how massive these ice sheets and glaciers are. But you also see the melting effects of it. And it's just like these things aren't meant to melt that fast. Like these things are tumultuous, large, gigantic structures. And they're just kind of falling apart, and just like it was a sight to see. Like it's a definitely a beautiful thing to see, but it's also kind of depressing, you know what I mean? Anyways, another point is less sea ice. So a lot of people forget about sea ice, myself included. Like I'm not a geographer by training, I didn't know much about geography, but anyway, sea ice is a huge component that people overlook, because it's not like one of those big gigantic structures that you get to see in nice pictures. It's literally just frozen water, but it's huge for transportation. So especially for Inuit communities. So a lot of them use frozen water or sea ice as a method of transport. Let's say they're, because they don't have actual infrastructure or highways. So they have to use snowmobiles on this ice to kind of get around places, to travel to communities, to resupply, get new supplies, visit family members, things like that. So it's a huge thing for them. It's also huge for animals. So when you see images of polar bears and things like that on sea ice, it's actually like kind of a good thing, because they have the ability to hunt from there. That's kind of what they use for hunting things like seals and whales, because they need to be able to be on the water, not just on the land. So sea ice is critical for them hunting. That way they can smell the animals and things like that. Even for Inuit people, like there has to be sea ice, so that way like their sled dogs can smell where the prey is and kind of determine the right location. That way the hunter can kind of pounce and kind of capture their prey. But yeah, that's huge. And because of the loss of sea ice, you'll start to see passages opening up. And that's what kind of leads to the increase of tourism and kind of all that whole talk of opening up the Northwest Passage to trade routes, because it's a shorter path. And things like that. And there's more economic opportunities for mining and oil and gas exploration and fracking, which, yeah, sure, boosts the economy. But in terms, if you think about the long-term environmental impacts, the loss of sea ice is not going to be a net positive thing, right? It's going, sure, you can get some positives out of it, but overall, for the longevity and sustainability of our planet, the loss of sea ice is not a good thing, because it also contributes to the albedo effect. So pretty much the lighter surfaces reflect the solar radiation, and so with less sea ice, there's more dark surface exposed, which is in the water, which kind of absorbs that heat, and that heats up the remaining sea ice, which melts it even faster, which means there's less, even less surface area to be reflect the solar radiation. And so it kind of creates a feedback loop and kind of just melts and melts and melts and just continues to get warmer and warmer. And that's kind of, it's a huge problem. But anyways, I don't want to get too much into the science or geography of it. I'll just move on to the like the animal ranges of, so how the intermediate impacts of climate change are affecting animal ranges. So like I mentioned, we went to a community, Pond Inlet, and a woman was telling us that usually for a lot of food and clothing and things like that, they would rely on caribou because they're relatively easy to hunt. There's an abundance of them. But nowadays, because of climate change and shifting, and then shorter season, shorter hunting seasons, shifting seasonal changes and things like that, and less food available, the caribou ranges are shifting. So they're kind of moving more inland away from the communities because that's where the food is. And so it makes it harder and like more inaccessible for these Inuit communities to get to them without putting themselves at more harm's risk. So now they're having to start to rely on more animals, which leads to overhunting. So she was telling us that now that the caribou are gone, she's relying a lot more on seal for subsistence. And so, and if everyone's starting to hunt more seal, that's going to have a huge impact on the seal population. And then if polar bears can't hunt seals, the polar bear population is going to go down. And it's all interconnected, that whole food web, you know, that stuff you learned in like grade 8. Yeah, now it's coming to life, eh? Like that all comes to fruition. Like we don't see it in real time, but it's stuff that happens, and the people who have been living off this land, they're the people who experience it first, so they recognize these impacts. How has climate change affected traditional practices in northern communities? So like I mentioned, it's finding new animals to rely on. But the one thing I want to mention is that it's becoming more and more kind of westernized and intertwined with our culture. Like they're becoming more dependent on us and governments in order for their communities to stay afloat. Like you'll start to see that more and more market food is being introduced. So they're relying less on hunting their own food and gathering their own food and making their own clothes and things like that, to more of a transition to kind of having that stuff accessible to them in a commercialized setting. And that's kind of the blending of cultures and things like that, which you could argue is a good thing or a bad thing, but it's interesting because some people will think, like, even like not my personal opinion, but there was one story that a man was telling us on the ship. That so there was an indigenous man, and then he was telling him that like he grew up with like 5 or 6 brothers or sisters, and then all of his brothers died from like malnutrition or whatever, and then this guy became like a tour operator or something, and like he sold his art, or I forgot what the details were, but anyways, like a white man came and visited him, and then like he was like thank you for the white man and coming and saving my life, because pretty much it was because of these people, or because of tourists, that this guy was able to survive. He's like, I have a nice home, I have a heated home, I have a television, my family goes to school, and that's because, sure, my culture is lost, but I'm still able to live and kind of prosper. And so it's kind of an interesting take, because most people will kind of see it as a negative thing, but at the same time, this guy's kind of, in his sense or in his reality, he's living life, right? Like he's Gucci, he's like, he's on top of the world because he's got money, he's got safety, he's got security. And so it's just an interesting dynamic to see what different people's take on it are. Another thing I wanted to mention is that there's a loss of culture. So because of the mixing, there's a loss of culture. And this was a huge issue talking to some of the elders. They were saying that younger generations are scared to kind of take on their traditional responsibilities. And like, I completely understand that. Like, if I was in that environment, I'm not like I can't sympathize or empathize with them because I'm nowhere near that situation. But anyways, like I wouldn't want to be going out and hunting for seals on sea ice that's less than a meter thin, or like being uncertain of whether or not it could collapse at any given moment, and like just being able to physically hunt and being able to learn those skills, like that's scary. Like these kids are scared that, like, for one, that there's no more food left, two, that they don't know how to do it, they haven't learned the skills properly, or three, it's just like the uncertainty of the climate and uncertainty of the future. It's like, is this a sustainable way of living? Is this something that's worth learning? Because will I be able to pass it down, or will it be something that dies with me? And that's something that younger generations are kind of scared. They're kind of scared to follow their roots because they don't know whether or not that this is going to be a viable option for them maybe 5-10 years down the road. And that's kind of a scary thought, even for me. And like, I'm not even in that situation. Imagine how scary it is for a 12-year-old who's got to decide whether or not like they should kind of pursue a higher education or to kind of just live off the land. The impacts of shipping and Arctic tourism. Because, like I mentioned, the loss of sea ice, it becomes more accessible to people. So that's why you start to see more shipping, more Arctic tourism. And so even in Greenland, we saw, like, I didn't expect this, but we saw a hell of a lot of ships. And I was, like, certainly surprised because I wouldn't expect that, like, in the high Arctic. But it just shows that, like, tourism is a huge industry. And now that it's becoming more accessible, more and more people want to become exposed to it. And so, yeah, there's always going to be pros and cons when it comes to tourism in these kinds of areas. But I think you can look at it however you want. But there's some of these communities that wouldn't be there without tourism, if you think about it that way. Like, some of these communities, they're only being held afloat because of the economic revenue that they're getting through tourism. And that's an important dynamic to consider. Like, sure, like, they're trampling over the land. They're kind of putting a strain on resources and things like that. But at the same time, they're also contributing to people's livelihoods. They're kind of they're kind of learning about new cultures. So yeah, there's always going to be pros and cons, but I think it's important that we recognize those pros and cons and kind of do what we can to mitigate the negative impacts and kind of do what we can to kind of bolster those positive impacts. So kind of contribute to the local economy, learn more about the culture, respect the land, do what we can to conserve and help those resources and those environments and stuff like that. Because tourism is an industry that isn't going to die. It's probably only going to get bigger from this point on. And so it's important that we have it in a sustainable fashion, because without having sustainable tourism, it's going to become rampant. Because as most of you know, with money, you can do just about anything, right? Like, if you have enough money, you can do whatever the hell you want. So it's important that we have regulations, we have guidelines, and kind of not even that, just teaching people general respect for the land and kind of appreciating it for what it is and kind of understanding that these are some of the most sensitive and fragile ecosystems in the world. And we have to respect that and kind of understand that these aren't meant for mass tourists. And eventually we're going to have to say no to people, because I feel like we shouldn't be opening up the doors of tourism to mass numbers like that. Just like, imagine, like, you know, those Caribbean cruises where you have tens of thousands of people. Like, that would not be able to happen in the Arctic. And like, my biggest fear is that will become a possibility. And so that's just something that you have to consider in the future. But in terms of like how it affects locals, like the impacts of shipping and Arctic tourism, so there's things like the technology of smart ice. So that kind of, it's a cool little technology because it kind of maps out the thickness of ice in the area. So that way, like I mentioned, like Inuit people rely on this for transportation. So it kind of maps out which routes are safe and things like that, which routes are more susceptible to collapse, kind of understanding and mapping the different ice dynamics and ice conditions are in, so that way they can kind of, there's a sense of peace of mind and kind of safety, knowing that there's signs behind the land that they're kind of being exposed to, and it's kind of like hard facts and hard data that kind of emphasizes that, okay, this place is safe to go to and this place isn't. So that's kind of a nice thing to have. But at the same time, it's also difficult because technology is kind of a hard concept to grasp in those communities in terms of accessibility, because they're not that quite familiar with it. And it's kind of like, how do you disseminate that information to people in a way that's understandable, which is another challenge, kind of that communication barrier, because a lot of people, you know, they speak English, but at the same time, they're kind of really tied in with their tradition and roots in their language. And so Inuit people speak Inuktitut. And so that's kind of, they don't really want to hone away from that. They want to kind of embrace that. And so, yeah, communication is another big thing, especially with governments and tourists and things like that. So that's another kind of thing that I saw. Like, you'll start to see signs in English, but people were talking about how they're kind of reluctant to put up signs in English because it kind of shows the assimilation and stuff like that. But yeah, I think that's like kind of the more technical questions that people had about what it's kind of like in the Arctic and kind of the changes that are happening because of climate change. So like the last question that I had was, what's the general landscape like and what's it like being the last frontiers left and kind of what part resonated with me the most? And so if we're being honest, like the part that resonated, okay, so I'll start with the general landscape. The general landscape, it's like you're not on this planet. It's like you're on Mars. It's so barren. Like I was walking through, like walking towards glaciers and walking on these rocks and these beaches and like these ponds and things like that. It's like you're in a movie. It's like you're in like Lord of the Rings, like you're in back on Middle Earth or something, right? It's like it's untouched, pristine, no signs of civilization. Like these are truly one of the last untouched landscapes, like that. I'm using that word very loosely because obviously nowadays everything is impacted by human activity, but yeah, that's just, it was just unreal. It's surreal just to see the different kind of the different geology, the different geography, different temperatures. It's just like I can't, like it's just unreal. Like it's people think of like a barren, snowy, icy landscape, but it's really more like people say like it's a frozen desert. That's really what it is. It's a frozen desert, but it's just really, 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 really fucking cool. That's honestly the best way I can describe it. And so what's it like being the last frontiers left? So I felt extremely privileged just to be up there because I know not many people get to be up there, and especially being with being a part of a research team, kind of going to places that not many public members get to go to and be exposed to and kind of learn, not only just like being a tourist and like seeing things, but kind of experiencing and learning them and kind of understanding what's going on, how changes are impacting people, how changes are impacting the land. And so it's unreal that this is it, right? Like if this is gone, like we're gone, right? Like this will completely change our world. Like if the glaciers melt, if Greenland melts, it's over. Like it's game over, right? Like, and so that's why I tell people it's breathtaking up there, but it's also depressing. Like obviously if you went back there maybe 50 years ago, it would just be beautiful, but now it's just depressing because you know how fast it's going and it's going to be gone within a matter of decades. And the thing is, like, we're not doing enough to stop it. And you can see it, and people like me are worried. But imagine the people who live there. Imagine what they're going through. It's a lot tougher for them because it's a reality for them. Like for us, we're probably going to be fine, right? But for them, when their homes are kind of falling apart because of permafrost melt, or when they can't get food because the caribou are moving, or their home's displaced because of rising sea level or something, or they don't have enough money to get access to diapers or things like that. Like it's a rough life. And so that's kind of what resonated with me the most. It's a completely different social dynamic too, I just can't imagine living off the land. We learn about this as children. We learn about indigenous people and how they were there first and kind of understanding and respecting them as kind of the First Nations and stuff like that. But we don't actually understand how hard it is, how hard their circumstances are, how their situation is. Like, imagine if you had to pick up your shit and just, like, leave and just go to the Arctic and just fend for yourself, like, kind of hunt for your own food, kind of find your own, like, way of making an income, kind of learn the language. It's just really tough, and that's kind of like what resonated with me the most, is that we're so privileged and so like, and like we have all this technology, we have all these solutions, and like we don't implement them. And that's the part that bothers me, is that because there are people out there who are actually facing the effects of climate change right now, and that's something we don't see, right? Something that we're fortunate enough to be sheltered by, like we're sheltered from the effects of climate change. But it's completely different. Like it really makes you open your eyes and think about how your life is, how your actions are influencing the environment, kind of understanding the different social dynamics that occur between different cultures, and kind of understanding different people's belief systems, especially with nature, and kind of how you see nature. Because I really love how the Inuit people kind of look at nature and kind of have that relationship of mutual respect and understanding, and kind of having a holistic view of everything, and kind of nothing is wasted, everything is interconnected. And I feel like that's the way it should be, but because of the way we live, we're so separate, and then we're not kind of intertwined the way that they are. And that again comes with the geographical and situational circumstances, but I think that's just really cool. And so again, like the one last thing that someone asked me was, what are some solutions you had to stop climate change or the greenhouse gas emission effect and polar amplification and stuff like that? And so I'm laughing because like I could spit solutions back and forth with you, like stop eating meat, stop taking your car to work, take public transit, stop buying new clothes, reuse your clothes, recycle, blah blah blah, stop using plastic water bottles. There's so many different solutions out there, and that's kind of what the depressing part is. Like we already know, like, the technical solutions to solve this problem exist. The biggest barrier right now is just political will, right? Like, we have, like, there's no support for this, right? Because we're not accustomed to it, we're not exposed to it, it's not directly impacting us. Like, once climate change starts impacting us directly, I guarantee you tons of money will flood into climate change adaptation and climate funding. But right now, that's not the priority because we're not affected, right? Like, well, North Americans at least, right? So that's why you kind of see even like the Global Climate Action Summit that just happened a few days ago. Like, you'll see like the countries that are doing the most are the countries that are most affected, because they realize this shit is real, right? And they have to do something. And people and the countries like Japan, Brazil, the U.S. are all the countries who haven't pledged anything, who haven't promised anything, because why devote resources to something that hasn't impacted you yet, right? So, yeah, my biggest solution is, well, I think this is fitting, but go vote for a politician you believe in. Go vote for someone you believe in, someone who you think will create change, someone who falls in line with your ideologies and beliefs and things like that, someone who supports not only just the environment, but sustainability as a whole. Like, it's, people think that this is an environmental issue. It's not an environmental issue. It's a humanitarian issue. It's an economic issue. it's an all-in-one issue, you know what I mean? It's everything's wrapped in one messy little bundle. That's what I like to say. But yeah, it's a very interdisciplinary subject, and in order to solve an interdisciplinary subject, it requires interdisciplinary collaboration. And so that involves you, as mostly Canadians listening to this, using your democratic right and voting for someone who you think is capable of leading that charge or leading that frontier. And so, like, I encourage you to kind of really weigh out your options this upcoming election, and kind of see whose party or platform resonates with you the most, and kind of not only resonates with you, but your ideologies now and even in the future. So maybe you're looking for jobs in the future. Maybe you're looking to have kids in the future. What kind of political system do you want that's going to set you up for success in the future? Not even just you, but like your future generations, your community, the environment, the economy. Those are all things you have to consider. But yeah, anyways, that's all I got to say. I know this was a quick kind of summary of the Arctic. There's probably a lot more I could go into detail about. I apologize, but this was the best I could do. I really just wanted to get this out just because a lot of people were asking me, how's your trip? How is it like being in the Arctic? So this is kind of what it's like, right? Like, it's unreal, but it was a blast, but it just emphasizes how beautiful, how intrinsically beautiful our planet is, but also how depressing it is to see that it's going to shit real, real quick. Right? So, yeah, anyways, so just to end off, I just want to say Karakumik, or Kwana, which is thank you in Inuktitut. I know I probably butchered that, but anyways, thanks again for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed that brief little summary of the Arctic. And so, yeah, stay tuned for future episodes. And I really hope that you guys kind of learn something about the Arctic and kind of get like a brief glimpse of what it's like up there. And just the biggest thing I want you guys to take away from this is that, yeah, you might not get to go to the Arctic, you might not get to experience it, but you have to know that it's there, it's interconnected with us, it's part of one big system. And so I want you guys just remember that in the back of your mind when you're voting this October, and kind of really weigh your options and kind of think about things from a new perspective. If you haven't thought about something from an environmental angle, think about it from an environmental angle. If you haven't thought about something from an economic angle, think about it from an economic angle. You know what I mean? So kind of just weigh your options, understand what exactly you're voting. You're not just voting for a candidate, you're voting for your future, right? So yeah, it's just don't blindly vote. Don't not vote. Vote for a life that you believe in. Vote for a future you believe in. And vote for a platform that you believe in. And if there is no platform that you believe in, then use your voice to advocate for that. Be like, hey, this guy's not talking about the issue that I'm interested in. And put him on blast. And be like, hey, why aren't you talking about this? And kind of challenge people, challenge ideas, and challenge what people are doing. That's the only way you're going to make a change. Look at Greta Thunberg. Like, she's challenging the system, and she's like 16. She's challenging every politician on this planet because they haven't done shit, and she's sacrificing everything to kind of make a change. Thank you for listening to the I Speak for the Trees podcast and supporting the fight against climate change. If you haven't already, please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Spotify and Apple Music. For more information, feel free to visit www.ispeakforthetrees.com. Until next time, speak for the trees, save the bees, and let's keep it below 1.5 degrees. Peace out, y'all.